Great. So we had a lot of questions from the audience. I want to start with, I think maybe the most common question I'll give to Dr. Murphy is that there's a lot of concern or lack of clarity in the rheumatology mind about risk assessment and risk stratification. You know, so I think the easy answer is we should probably do a cardiovascular risk score and plug in those numbers, but I don't think we do that. So how do you make this more practical for your rheumatology colleagues?
Yeah, it's a great question. And as you probably all know in the audience, these risk scores are probably a good starting point, right? Recognizing that they've been trialed, right? And that we've been trying to develop better risk scores, but they don't. So we know that they can underestimate the true risk in a patient with rheumatoid arthritis or another systemic inflammatory disorder. But I still think that's a good starting point, right? Because what those risk scores do capture, right? They capture cardiovascular risk factors, age, gender, all of which are important. However, I don't think we should rely just on that calculator, right? So when I meet a patient, I try to address all the known cardiovascular risk factors that we would think of: hypertension, high cholesterol, family history. I also think about other markers of risk, such as checking lipoprotein A, a high PCCRP, understanding their disease activity. And then based on the age of the patient, I have a discussion with the patient on what we could further do to really truly understand that risk to then be able to initiate a therapy. If we're trying to decide on, does this patient qualify for statin therapy, would that be additional? And what I utilize a lot in the clinic, and that I want to make sure that the rheumatologist feel empowered to do, is actually utilize imaging. And we've actually got a lot of ways we can do that, right? And so one of the kind of most common tests I do to really understand somebody's risk, as long as, you know, they're not young, under 40, is I would do a coronary artery calcium score. Very quick, takes a minute, very low dose radiation. And we get a very clear answer of whether at that point in time they have atherosclerosis. And if they have atherosclerosis, then I can clearly actually start to initiate therapies in that patient. And I also use that to kind of judge how much athero they have, and where we discuss the benefit of adding something like aspirin onto their statin.
Do you think we can dichotomize this simply by saying, like, going through those steps, but trying to identify high risk patients? And how would you define that? I mean, Hani sort of defined a high risk patient that because they're double seropositive and now they have symptoms, and they may progress to RA. What would you hang your high risk patient criteria on?
Yeah. Well, I think putting the cardiology hat on the high risk criteria, I completely agree in terms of the rheumatologic factors of high risk. And then when I look at it at the cardiology angle, things that clue me in are those additional risk factors, right? And so I would be considering a higher risk patient somebody that has, and the common things we don't want to forget, right? Obesity, family history, always asking family history. Really important to talk about, do you have a family history of coronary artery disease? And if so, is it premature? Do you have hypertension? Do you have high cholesterol? Oftentimes, you know, we will see untreated high cholesterol for many years, and we know that that increases risk over time. Regardless, even though the nuances of lipids and rheumatoid arthritis and other inflammatory disorders may be nuanced, but they still impact risk. And so those are kind of the things that I would start to clue in as higher risk patients. And of course, if anybody's had any type of vascular event, then they would be also considered high risk.
So I want to extend this concept or idea of high risk to the other two speakers. Hani, how would you define the high risk rheumatoid, the high risk not rheumatoid that may progress? And what would you hang your hat on there, or want the audience to know about?
You know, for me, the most compelling thing is two measurements separated by 6 to 12 months that suggest that there is evolution of the autoimmune response. So the most readily available measure is an increase in the level of the autoantibodies. And as I mentioned, if you start out with ACPA positive, rheumatoid factor negative, rheumatoid factor tends to occur later in the course of preclinical disease than ACPA. If rheumatoid factor now is positive along with ACPA, that's a really big red flag. If the ACPA titers are going up, it suggests to me epitope spreading, maturation of the B cell responses, B and T cell health. I pay a lot of attention to that.
Yeah. Dr. Guma, you know, we don't really talk much about diet, but should we be identifying our high-risk patients based on their diet?
That's a good question. So, as I discussed before, there is like a real lack of good observations and longitudinal like studies to answer that question. So there are some results like the one that he explained about this kind of like studies that the endpoint was not RA, but then they checked RA and autoimmune diseases where you see that taking vitamin D and omega-3 really like decrease the risk. So I would say that if you have a patient that really like has a very unhealthy diet, you could potentially think that that is another like a environmental trigger, no? That is there in the list of triggering the disease. But still, we don't have really strong evidence for that.
So there are a number of questions about the Mediterranean diet and then anti-inflammatory. Are they one and the same, or how would you, anti-inflammatory seems very, magazine-like and is out there and sort of means nothing to everyone. But Mediterranean is anti-inflammatory, but is an anti-inflammatory diet a Mediterranean diet, or is it different?
So to clarify, most of the anti-inflammatory diets that they are called themselves anti-inflammatory diets are based on plant-based diet, like a Mediterranean diet. So they are based on that. What the anti-inflammatory diet recommend is there is some ingredients that the classical med or healthy diet don't contain, like some amounts of like a curcuma or some amounts of different ingredients that they are added to that. So it's true, this magazine thing name, I agree with you, but most of them, they actually have a little bit more than the classical plant-based or Mediterranean-based diet. That's what they are called, anti-inflammatory diet. But I agree with you, sorry, that the med diet is an anti-inflammatory diet, so it kind of gets interconnected.
Honey.
Yeah, if I could just ask Dr. Guma a question about that. There is ways of measuring the inflammatory index of anybody's diet, and there's tools out there, the ASA24 and this kind of thing. Do you use those in clinical practice and research? Do they give you enough information that you can take somebody's diet and say, this is how inflammatory or anti-inflammatory your diet is?
So in my experience, it depends on the population. So some population, depending on the diet that they take, you can use those index. But those index are a little bit kind of like a restrictive because they only give like a points that, I mean, to a bunch of like a food. And some of our population, they actually don't use that ingredients. They use different ones. So those tools are very helpful for research, are good. We don't use those because our like a diet logs, they actually contain different ingredients, different foods that they are not in those index. But it would be like a good way to stratify and normalize all these like a diet logs, no? Like you really put an anti-inflammatory index. But I think that it needs to be much more spread out to different populations because populations, especially in this country, they really eat very different. And in San Diego, for instance, we have a bunch of like a different subgroups that they eat very different, and you cannot really use that anti-inflammatory score for that.
So we have a lot of questions virtually. Anybody in the audience wants to go to the microphone, we'll take questions. Dr. Cavanaugh, the microphone.
Yeah, thank you all very much. What a great session. And I think Jack set this up. When you look at the Mediterranean diet and Dr. Gamacho, the pictures of it, on medical talks, there's no alcohol. But if you go to the Mediterranean, look at the Mediterranean diet, there's always bottles of alcohol all over. So what about the role of alcohol? And I'll ask Dr. Weber, too. It seems like all the cardiologists used to have a couple of glasses of red wine and claim it was for cardiac prevention. And Dr. Gabalaway as well. I mean, alcohol, it comes up all the time. And when patients ask about prevention of the cardiovascular disease, but also how does that affect any issue with rheumatoid arthritis?
We're looking to clarify the healthy side of our reception tonight at 5. So let's start with Dr. Guma on alcohol effect. Is it affecting the microbiome, or what's it doing?
Yeah, very briefly, it's true that there is no like a real data about like inflammation, but the med diet really like includes wine. So we in our trials don't restrict wine other than what is accepted in the med diet. So when we actually went to all the literature, we found papers pro and anti-inflammation. It was really all over the place. So, and we know that he probably will mention about the cardiovascular benefits. So, yes, the classical one, two glasses of like a red wine is because of the, all these polyphenols is accepted in the diet. Yeah, we don't restrict that.
Honey, where does it fit in? We know it's anti-inflammatory. Now, does it play any role in this preclinical phase?
Specifically alcohol or just diet?
Alcohol.
Okay.
Unless your diet is all alcohol.
No comment on that. But I would like to add, just, you know, I'm going to divert that alcohol question, is that we're quite interested in the immunomodulatory impact of diet at this stage of when you're not at the point of no return. Maybe you're earlier, and we have an animal model where we gave the mice a combination of curcumin, omega-3, and vitamin D, collagen-induced arthritis, and we almost entirely prevented the onset of it if it was given at the same time as the induction agent. So I think there is potentially an immunomodulatory role for these anti-inflammatory supplements and diet in addition to the anti-inflammatory role.
So, Brittany, is alcohol just a vascular effect, or is it an anti-inflammatory effect and its cardiac benefits?
Yeah, these are all excellent points, and I would disagree with the first two. Of course, there is always the data that we quote a lot in terms of cardiovascular benefits, particularly in the red wine and the polyphenols, as mentioned. And I think it's all in the context. And so I do, you know, I never have a problem with my patient saying they have alcohol, including red wine or wine in general, in moderation. And the key is always moderation. And that's really always the discussion. And that's where we always have some tension when we're talking about this, because there's a lot of reasons I'm always counseling my patients that they really have to limit the alcohol, right? A lot of times patients are having things like palpitations, arrhythmias, atrial fibrillation. Too much alcohol can trigger atrial fibrillation. So I certainly think there is probably benefit at that lower dose of moderation. It's always just discussing with my patient what that means to them and counseling them on what could be the side effects if you were to go over that kind of benefit of moderation.
Okay, we have a question from the microphone. Go ahead.
Now, there was a time when gluten-free diet was the toss of the town. Can you kindly comment on the gluten-free diet, please?
So in that ACR guideline that I mentioned, really there are the list of randomized trials about all these like a different type of like elimination diets, like for instance the gluten diet. And the data is there, but because, again, most of these trials, they found a reason for bias, okay? They couldn't comment on those diets. So we know, because we have our own patients, that they tell you very clear, I stop eating the gluten and I flare less. And individually, I'm sure it's true. What happens in these diet studies that I was trying to explain with the microbiome and all the interaction is that really is very personalized, but the same as the treatment, no? Because methotrexate is also like doesn't work for everyone the same. So it's very personalized, and that's why if we don't have really good trials that we can show as an evidence, we should not like recommend like a general, you know, like a raca bean because of that. I would recommend to go over those the guidelines, like the supplementary information to find the reason why they didn't think that those elimination diets, they were good, okay? So again, I simply want to clarify that it doesn't mean that they are not good or there is no some evidence there, but when they reviewed all the trials, they found some bias, and that's why they didn't recommend some of the elimination diets. Again, it doesn't mean that they are not good for some patients, or maybe will have a better randomized trial that they will show the evidence of those elimination diets.
Honey, I have a question about you set up the not yet RA patient by using European clinically suspect arthralgia. It also out there is preclinical RA, undifferentiated RA. The nomenclature here, is it all the same? Is it different to you? Is this need explaining, or is it still amorphous and we're going to work it out later on?
Well, I think your latter statement is probably the most correct one, but the problem with talking about preclinical RA is that you assume you already know the people that are going to develop RA, and you're just getting them earlier and earlier. What I hope what I had demonstrated is that you've got this process that in some individuals culminates in the development of inflammatory arthritis. In quite a substantial number of people, it doesn't. And so calling this the preclinical phase of RA and everything that we're studying, I think that the two cases really illustrate that conundrum quite nicely. In the one case, you're probably dealing with preclinical RA. You're at a phase which is months before the disease starts. In the second case, you have no clue. You really don't know where that. So you can't call that preclinical RA, whether you call it benign RA autoimmunity and so on. So that's the problem with the nosology right now.
So this is going to be addressed later on this afternoon by Dr. Karp, who's going to talk about preclinical labels in lupus. There's one question that people asked about your treatment. Why did you say you would treat that patient with methotrexate for a year and reassess? Is there a rationale to that other than...
Yeah. The rationale for that is what the treat earlier study from the Netherlands showed, is that they treated for a year and they stopped. Now, we all know that stopping methotrexate at a dose of 25 milligrams sub-Q is potentially problematic. So I'm advocating for more of a taper because I really don't know what treating at this stage, before the inflammation has started, what methotrexate does. So all I can do is follow the evidence that we have currently, which is you treat for a year and people seem to get milder disease. And people will receive the prospect of being treated for a limited period of time and then seeing how they do off of treatment, I think, considerably better.
Okay. We have a question from the microphone.
For Dr. Weber and the panel, Dr. De Jesus, in our rheumatoid arthritis patients that have COVID vaccines, do they have more cardiovascular risk or less cardiovascular risk?
The question, if they get COVID vaccine?
Rheumatoid patients that already had one or two COVID vaccines.
Yeah. I always count the patients to get the COVID vaccine, and I don't believe it raises their cardiovascular risk. If anything, it would, you know, we are always saying in patients they should be getting their COVID vaccine because the risk and benefit ratio. So I would never say it raises cardiovascular risk. And I don't think we have good data that it would lower in terms of if you think about long-term benefit, but I think that, of course, if a patient has cardiovascular risk factors, obesity or other cardiovascular risk factors, they would be at higher risk for those COVID complications. But I always counsel my patients on getting COVID vaccines and just appropriate vaccines. And one question I get a lot is if a rheumatoid arthritis or a lupus patient has had pericarditis, can they safely get a vaccine? And the data really is yes. And so we also encourage vaccines in that study too.
Brittany, a lot of questions online about, again, the colchicine indication. We find that really interesting. We're excited about it, but we don't know where it fits. So one, what's the uptake of this in the cardiology community? And two, knowing our patients are high risk, many of our diseases are high risk, how should this be applied to our population?
Yeah, thank you, John. And I love this question because I'm very excited that, you know, for cardiology, we have our first kind of anti-inflammatory target that we all know very well, right? We've all been using this for years and we already use another indication. I think your question is spot on. We need studies to do this, right? We need actually good studies, mechanistic studies that test adding colchicine in our patients with rheumatoid arthritis and other systemic inflammatory diseases. We can gather the cardiovascular data and dramatic benefit. I mean, it's really profound. You have 36-37% risk reduction by adding this, and it's such a potent, I want to say potent, but we know it blocks those key pathways down the inflammasome, which are really implicated in the atherosclerosis. So how I think about it, I think it has to be officially studied, but I do think there still is a role in our patients with systemic inflammatory diseases. If their disease is controlled, and they have atherosclerosis, right? And you're already controlling those other risk factors, and their CRP continues to be above 2, right? Which for a rheumatoid arthritis patient is not a high CRP, but that is really where we're finding the line for cardiovascular risk. Then I do think there is benefit. I think that earlier on, before there's afro, it's not, that would have to definitely be studied. But where I have used it so far is in my well-controlled patients who have significant atherosclerosis. Say if somebody had like severe atherosclerosis, such as the case I presented today, then I certainly think there is a role for adding that on. And I always, it's always a discussion with the rheumatologist at that point. And usually, you know, there's no reason we couldn't add it on, and then we add it on to their therapy.
So a natural consequence of that populace is that they have renal impairment. And
So that's a very good question. So the one, so when can you not use colchicine, right? That's your next question. So it's CKD, which is common, especially in people with cardiovascular risk factors, and it's in patients with liver failure. And then very rarely there are the true drug-drug interactions, which are really the antifungals. We've studied this at nauseam on the safety with statins, and this is a common question I get, including the large trials that did them with statins. But that is the one caveat, and those are places where you could not use colchicine, as right, is in renal failure. And I have a very cautious threshold. I wouldn't start it because you don't know where their trajectory is going, right? And you know this is long-term benefit. And that's where I think the cardiology field is really progressing, because we're now testing NLRP3 inflammasome inhibitors in coronary artery disease, and now we have 3 big trials looking at the IL-6 pathways. That are all going to be agents that one could use in the setting of kidney disease. However, when, you know, once we see those data, if they're positive, then it's going to be interesting how we think about that in our patients with inflammatory diseases who are already being treated with other pathways.
Dr. Fung at the microphone.
Yeah, I have a question for Dr. Weber. In practice, when we're using IL-6, and we do see the rising of the lipid,
yeah.
Theoretically, treating IL-6 did not show any message of cardiovascular risk. But as a tradition, we would try to treat them with statin. Is that necessary, or we are just over-treating the patient?
Yeah, this is a great question, and this is something I see a lot in my clinic, because I have a good fair number of patients on tocilizumab for their rheumatologic diseases, and we do see, and you know the data just as well, that it can raise lipids. And the question is always, does that little increase cardiovascular risk? I wouldn't say it increases cardiovascular risk, right? I actually think that if you actually think about all the mechanistic data, this is the key pathway, right, that's implicated that we're now blocking. But I still would treat the lipids. And I will tell you that just based on experience, a patient has a dramatically high LDL and they're on tocilizumab, it's not just the tocilizumab, right? Sometimes they don't have the data, but they generally had a predisposition before. So I still treat, and I would utilize a statin in that scenario. I may get a little more data with calcium score to understand plaque, but I would still treat. But I definitely think that there's beneficial effects also of the IL-6 inhibition. It's interesting with the ziltivecumab that is being tested in these three large-scale cardiovascular trials is that we're not seeing that increase in lipids, and it just has to do based on the different biology of how it's blocking. But good
yes.
question.
Some of our cardiology would do an NMR kind of subtyping of the lipid. You think there's a hyper doing the nuclear magnetic classification of the lipid, whether they are large molecule or small molecules. And you think this is just a hype or this is necessary?
Oh, you mean doing advanced lipidomics? Is that what you're asking? Testing all the advanced, testing particle size? I have patients that come to me with those profiles and, you know, of all of these data. And I'm not going to act clinically on that because we don't have data to really say how to best act data on that. So, I certainly think that these are all still areas of active research, but I truly would not feel comfortable not treating a patient with an LDL of 199, even if those advanced lipidomics look less inflammatory, because we know the linear relationship between LDL and the development of cardiovascular disease is so strong, and I wouldn't blame that LDL value also just on the IL-6. And almost always these patients will have had high cholesterol before they started the therapy. I also see this a lot with JAK inhibitors, right? If patients are on high-dose JAK or on JAK where you can see a rise in the lipids. And again, it's often that they've, you know, they've had that before, and then we discuss kind of implementation of therapies.
Let me follow up on the Jack, because that came up a number of times. People want to know, Dr. Weber, your approach to Jack use in patients with cardiovascular risk, knowing the results of the oral surveillance study. And I want to put out the idea that JAKs don't cause more cardiovascular problems. They weren't as good at preventing cardiovascular problems as was a TNF inhibitor. So what is your policy, or how do you approach this problem about JAK use?
You hit it right on, right? We cannot say that. We cannot say that, right? Because it was compared to a TNF. And we've also all have seen the reassuring data that's come out from all the meta-analysis, right, that is not showing this concern and a risk. And if we now really break down, as so many really elegant rheumatology reviews have done, that data, it is truly those people who were having events were those patients who were high cardiovascular risk, right, and not treated on statins. And so when I'm risk stratifying a patient on a JAK inhibitor, I always take into account all the standard cardiovascular risk factors. If they've already had a cardiovascular event, then I would say this is a higher risk patient profile right now, right? But that does not mean you have to stop the therapy, other than I'll work with them to try to optimize everything I can do for their cardiovascular risk. But when there's other therapy options, and you know, then we may decide to go to a different one. Of course, thrombosis is one that we would, and at least the rheumatologists I work with would stop, right, in that setting. But I think what you're also hinting on is that what we can't say, right? And so I always discuss what we do know with a patient and what we don't know. And I think whether in a patient with vascular disease, what that JAK inhibitor is actually doing mechanistically, right, compared to something like a TNF blocker, that's where we really are going to have to get some basic studies, right, mechanistic studies to show, really trying to understand what these pathways are doing.
All right, so Dr. Guma, the question, I like the idea that the diet is involved in shaping the microbiome. Do you think that there's, short of doing fecal transplant therapy, do you think there is a role for probiotics? There is already supportive data for that, or prebiotics even, that we should be thinking about?
Well, so changing diet, if you start like eating more fiber and everything, that's the prebiotic kind of like a concept, so that you are shaping the microbiome because of that. The probiotic, that really means to take those like a bacteria, no, with pills or yogurt or whatever, the literature is also all over the place, okay? The main important thing is the bacteria, if you are actually able to engraft that bacteria in your gut. So that's the reason why most of the probiotics don't work. It's because you are actually competing with your gut microbiome. And some of our gut microbiome, some of us will be able to engraft these no probiotics, but most of the time our gut microbiome will compete and will not let those bacteria to stay in the gut. So that's why the trials are so difficult to interpret. The fecal transplant thing is something that, of course, is a bit very aggressive, but I just put that as a concept because maybe not for RA, but there are like other diseases where if we find the right microbiome, that's another like a important question, is what is the right microbiome, how to shape the microbiome to a more like a healthy microbiome. Some studies suggest that for severe diseases like a Crohn disease, ulcerative colitis, there is a role there. So maybe in the future for severe lupus or severe RA, it could be a role.
Hadi, you mentioned or showed the association between rising titers of CCP in that early phase where they're leading up to clinically manifest disease associated with epitope spreading. Can you explain to the audience again what that means as far as pathogenesis? Does that mean we're definitely now in RA territory, or what's that association?
Thanks for raising that. And I'm actually, I didn't mention one thing which I should mention, which is the role of genetics. And the question that arises is, if you take somebody with a CCP positive, you're not sure where they are, and you think that they are well into that trajectory, is there a benefit of knowing what their HLA-DRB1 status is? Do they have shared epitope?
Or these polygenic risk scores that people are talking about.
Exactly. But, the big driver of that is the HLA-DRB1. I think if you look at the contribution of the other genes, it's dwarfed by HLA. So the question is, if you go out there and get somebody like that, should you check and see if they're shared epitope positive or not? And my answer to that is that it depends on the background frequency of that in your population. If you're dealing with a population that's primarily Caucasian, we know that the minority of people are going to have these encoding genes that will encode for the shared epitope. Population I deal with, 80% of the background population has shared epitope. So it doesn't give you as much information. But I think that, you know, the point here is that there is no question that if the HLA-DRB1 is playing a key role in this disease onset, it is at that stage of maturing, the autoantibody response, T cells interacting with B cells, T follicular helper cell, T peripheral helper T cells, all of which is dependent on that interaction around the HLA-DRB1. And it may ultimately provide us valuable information.
So that's a good clue as to what's going on immunologically by just watching the CCP rise. You also made the association between grip strength loss and tenosynovitis. Do you think that's reliable?
The Dutch think it is. They've done more MRI studies than anybody in the world, for sure. And they think that that tenosynovitis, of particularly the flexor tendons and the tendons around the wrist, you know, right around the extensor and the flexor tendons, is the earliest manifestations of rheumatoid arthritis, actually before you actually get synovitis in the joints. So they feel that this is a pretty important indicator of where this inflammatory process is going.
Yeah, and there are multiple studies showing the predictive value of tenosynovitis in those that will go on to develop RA who are in that trajectory phase. So
yeah.
All right,
the physical sign, the point is, the physical sign for that is the reduced grip strength.
Yeah, yeah. That's great. All right, I want to thank our panel for a great, great discussion. Thank you, Brittany.
Thank you for listening to this reprise session from Room Now Live 2024. This session and these recordings were sponsored by AbbVie, UCB, and Amgen. Be sure to register for Room Now Live 2025 when you can have full access to all the videos, all the recordings, all the downloads, and all the board questions that come out of Room Now Live 2025.